for the following broadcast. Safety precautions around the COVID-19 coronavirus pandemic have affected a number of our broadcasts, and a repeat program has been selected for the following broadcast.
Taken from us, and that's our theme music from Joe Cocker, his track called Respect Yourself. I'm Sheldon Brown, and Mental Health Radio is brought to you and funded by Ember Wellbeing Trust. Well, today on Mental Health Radio, we're talking about spiders, vampires, and jail keys. So what's this got to do with mental health? Well, you might well ask. Those words are the part of a title of a book we're discussing today. It's a story of depression, mania, and losing one's mind. Here to talk about this book is author Brooke O'Neill, who works for Ember at one of its mental health services. The name of Brooke O'Neill is a pseudonym. A review on Kindle describes the book this way. Spiders, Vampires and Jail Keys is the captivating, very readable but painfully real account of Brooke O'Neill's struggle with bipolar disorder. We follow her descent from intelligent, capable nurse and caring mother and partner to compulsory treatment and then her rise to stability and health again. Her vivid and humorous retelling of events provides an insight into the often chaotic and despairing life of those suffering with mental illness. And just before we welcome Brooke, I do want to make a comment about our Deputy Prime Minister, Winston Peters, who attacked one of his former executives of the New Zealand First Party by discrediting him and claiming that he shouldn't be taken seriously because he has a mental health problem. This is the second time that the Deputy Prime Minister has used mental health as a way of undermining and demeaning people. I hope that other advocates of mental health will also feel strongly about Winston Peters' stance and take him to task. I think it's absolutely appalling that the Deputy Prime Minister of New Zealand is undermining all the work that advocates in mental health have done to try and reduce discrimination and reduce the stigma that surrounds mental health. So that's my little a rage for the day. Brooke, welcome to Take It From Us. How do you feel about that very complimentary review?
Oh, thank you, Sheldon, and thank you for having me on the show. Yes, I'm very, very happy with that review, and I couldn't have asked for more, really.
And the success of the book to date, you're selling it on Kindle.
Yes, I am, and I think up to date I've probably sold about 40 books, and I also I did it for free for a short time, and 120 books were downloaded.
Right. So they can access it on Kindle via Amazon. It's not via Tinder, is it? Which is when you and I met, I thought it was Tinder, not Kindle. I got a bit confused there, but yeah, so how can you access the book?
So at the moment it's only available on Amazon, and if you search up spiders, vampires and jail keys, that will come up. And at the moment it's $5. So if you download the Kindle app for free, you can then purchase it on Amazon.
Right. Oh, well, that's great. So your book is getting 5-star reviews, and I thought I had some of those to read out. But what stimulated you to write about your mental health vulnerabilities?
Well, when I was 29 years old, I had my first child, and it was about 5 days after the birth that I began to experience symptoms of bipolar disorder.
So When was that diagnosed? I mean, you already, like, you were feeling some symptoms. What were you feeling?
5 days after her birth, I came home, and it wasn't long after then I started experiencing hallucinations and also some delusions. I was at the time also experiencing depression.
So that must have been pretty frightening. You were a new mother. You'd just come back from maternity hospital. You had a young child to look after. What did you do?
Well, luckily I had a very caring husband. And at the time I had absolutely no idea what was going on. I did think that what I was thinking was quite strange, but I didn't say anything about it. So it
wasn't. You didn't say anything to your loving husband?
No, because I didn't have any insight really onto what was going on with me.
So who did you go to see?
Well, it was at one point that I started hysterically laughing, and he then twigged that something wasn't quite right and rung the mental health team and also my midwife. So it was within a couple of hours of that happening that I actually had a mental health team on our doorstep.
So that was the crisis team?
Yes, it was.
So what happened after that?
Well, immediately they put me on medication because they realised I was actually psychotic. And not long after that, they also put me in on antidepressants, which wasn't a good idea because underlying bipolar disorder actually caused, the antidepressants actually caused mania.
So who made the diagnosis that you were psychotic?
The psychiatrist said it was quite obvious because I was saying things to him that really weren't true. I thought he was Jesus. And obviously there was a lot of things that I was having hallucinations about my daughter, that she was actually a toddler and she'd only just been born, so it's pretty obvious.
Right, so what do you think tipped you into this vulnerable state?
Well, there is actually some family history of bipolar disorder in my family. Not that I was aware of that at the time. I think it was also probably hormones and definitely lack of sleep with having a baby.
Had there been any sort of indication that you may have had a mental health vulnerability before the birth of your child?
I definitely had anxiety, but it wasn't to the point of actually needing any help. Well, I didn't think so. At the age of 12, I also had a depressive episode, but that sort of went away after probably 6 months.
I mean, was that diagnosed, or did you just feel sad and thought something's not right?
I actually felt very, very sad, and I wanted to take my own life at the age of 12. And then I think it was only 6 months later, I think in hindsight, that I actually had a hypomanic episode. But it was never diagnosed as such.
So you're looking back, and with the value of hindsight, you've got more understanding of this. But when you were a 12-year-old, what did you think was happening to you?
I had no idea, and I did reach out for some help from guidance counsellors at school. And also, I also said to my mother that I wanted to kill myself. And at that sort of time, it was sort of brushed under the carpet and, it'll don't be so stupid. The guidance counsellors didn't really offer me much support at all.
So how did you go away from that sort of lack of recognition of what was happening to your mood?
Well, it sort of dissolved overnight at one point, and then I became very hyperactive at school, and I was still doing okay, but I was being thrown out of classes and, just generally being a bit of a clown, really.
So other than being a clown, what were other features of that hyperactivity?
I used to do as many activities as I could. So I was playing soccer, I was doing gymnastics, I was doing swimming sports, and I was not really sleeping much.
So how long were you able to sustain that before you dropped into the opposite sort of mood, which I guess is sadness and depression?
I didn't.
Oh.
No, I didn't have depression following that. I sort of maintained a very hypomanic childhood.
That must have been very taxing on you.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of it turned into being drugs and alcohol when I, you know, got to about 15 or 16.
Oh, okay. So what, you turned to drugs and alcohol to try and change what was happening to you, or?
I believe so. I think I was just self-medicating and just trying to keep my mood under control a bit.
And did those drugs, were they positive or negative?
Mixed with alcohol, they were terrible. And not long, probably in my early 20s, I decided not to dabble in any of that.
Did your parents, you were still living at home, or had you left home?
I was still living at home till I was almost 21, and I used to climb out the window.
Oh. And nobody knew you were climbing out the window.
No.
And nobody knew what you were doing after climbing out of the window.
No.
Okay. So you were experimenting, but what you're saying is that if you mixed the drugs with alcohol, what happened then? Did you get a really bad drop in mood, or...?
No, not really. It just made me really, really sick, as in vomiting. I actually didn't really have a drop in my mood until I had my daughter.
Right. Mm. So there were a few warning signs sort of leading up to the birth of your daughter, but nothing that signalled what was going to happen, what really happened to you.
No, nothing at all like that.
So did you, what sort of treatment did you get from mental health services?
I actually had a nurse looking after me for 3 months, and that included night shifts as well.
So that nurse came to your home?
Yes, she did. Oh, there were several of them.
Right.
Yeah.
So that was a sort of a community service, but they stayed with you overnight as well?
Yes, there was 3 8-hour shifts.
Wow. Mm. So
I was very, very unwell.
You were very unwell, but that was a very personal service.
The psychiatrist said he wanted to keep me out of hospital. If possible.
Was that explained as to why he wanted to keep you out of hospital?
I actually spoke to him not so long ago. That's sort of, you know, talking 18 years. And he said, oh, I recognise you. And I said, I recognise you too.
Yes.
And he said to me, how have you been? And I said, really good. And I said, I'm really happy that, you know, I was able to stay out of hospital. And he said that was my aim.
Right. Well, I guess as a new mother, what would have happened if you had been admitted to hospital? Who would have cared for your young daughter?
I'm pretty sure we would have been separated.
Right.
Probably for months, yeah.
And what, your daughter would have had to go into care, or...?
Oh, I guess there would have been my husband that would have been able to. I'm sure friends and family would have rallied around.
Right. Yeah. Well, let's take a music break on Mental Health Radio, Take It From Us. And we've got B.B. King, a bit of blues for our listeners today. And our first track is Just a Little Love.
You don't know it, and I don't know it either. Let me get a little more nerve. You got to get the groove going, though, you know. You begin to feel the groove? Yeah, it sounds all right to me. So we're gonna try. Some people die for hate, some die for love, some die because they don't have a mate, but all I want is a little love. All I've ever wanted, people, all I want is just a little love. Now you ask me, all I want, a little bit of love. Just a little love. All I've ever wanted, is just a little love. Now, are you ready? All I want is a little bit of love. All I want is a little bit of love. I say all I want is just a little bit of love. Let's do it again.
Sheldon Brown of Mental Health Radio, Take It From Us, and we are talking about Spiders, Vampires and Jail Keys, which is the title of a book written by Brooke O'Neill. That is her pseudonym. And I'm just wondering, Brooke, where did this title, Spiders, Vampires and Jail Keys, come from?
The spiders and the vampires were actually hallucinations that I experienced. Quite frightening, actually. Jail keys belong to... I had a nurse come and look after me who was actually working at the prison.
Oh!
Yes, and she obviously had done a morning shift and she'd come on to an afternoon and she decided not to take her uniform off. So me being very unwell, I thought she was going to lock me up.
And so she still had the corrections or prison uniform on?
Yes, she did.
Oh, really?
So, you know, being quite delusional, I actually thought she was going to take me away.
Or lock you up in the home.
Yeah, so I made sure she left quite... quite quickly.
Did you?
As quick as possible.
Well, what, she was supposed to be on an eight-hour shift and you...
Yeah, my husband was there, so, you know, I was acting up for her, so I think she preferred to go back to the prison.
Oh, really? You got rid of her?
Well, not as such, but I just said that she was stressing me out, so...
Yeah.
You know, it should never have happened, really.
You mean that somebody who was in a prison uniform shouldn't have arrived without changing and...
Yeah, and I said to her, what are you still doing with your uniform on then? She goes, well, I didn't have time and I want to make some extra cash.
Well, that's pretty honest, isn't it? I mean, so there was sort of upsides and downsides of this 24-7. It was 24-7?
Yes, it was.
Care?
Yeah, it was.
And so that allowed you to care for your newly born daughter?
Well, in actual fact, it was their job too to care for her, because when I was depressed or manic, I really couldn't look after her.
How did your husband and other loved ones respond to this massive change in your mental health?
Well, they never said anything. I think they were just going moment by moment, really. I'm sure they were very, very shocked.
Right.
You know, this person that's all of a sudden turned psychotic overnight. What do you say?
Have you since talked about it?
Yes. I mean, everyone in my family's pretty open about it. My husband especially has been my rock, and without him I probably wouldn't be here today.
Right. So what do you think might have happened if you hadn't had your husband as a rock?
I definitely would have been in hospital, and I think... I think he was a protective factor in my life, and if he hadn't been around, I probably would have passed away, I would say.
Have you been in an acute psychiatric unit at all?
Yes, I have.
So at some point you were taken to hospital?
A very serious suicide attempt left me on a ventilator because I couldn't breathe for myself anymore. And they decided, obviously, when I was a bit better, that they should put me under the Mental Health Act, and I had no choice but to go to hospital.
So that happened, what, after the birth?
No, we're probably talking probably 6 or 7 years ago, maybe.
Right. Yeah. So you'd had some experience of acute psychiatric care?
Yes, definitely. I mean, and it was for my own good, really.
You were put under the Mental Health Act. Did you get a reasonable explanation as to why that was happening?
I don't know if it's called reasonable.
Nothing reasonable about the Mental Health Act.
It was just, this needs to be done and you're going to the hospital and you've got no choice.
So you weren't really consulted?
No.
That's probably what happens. So you were put under. So I just to clarify, this happened before the birth of your child.
No, this was only probably 6 or 7 years ago. That serious suicide attempt.
Okay, so your daughter was what, some years old? If that's
she would have been about 12.
Right. Okay. Yeah. So you had another deterioration in your mental health?
I had several, actually, and they were really... it's hard to explain, really, but I decided that several times that I wouldn't take medication because I didn't need it, and I really didn't have bipolar disorder. And, yes, and that's what happened.
So that was contrary, I guess, to what your mental health professionals were telling you, that you should persist with the medication and that you did have bipolar.
Yes, that's correct. And I think too with bipolar disorder, unfortunately, the hypomania especially drives people, you know, because it's just like partying, really, and it's pretty much 24/7. So, you know, you kind of can chase those highs.
Right.
Because they feel so good. And, I mean, eventually they become overwhelming, but it's a sad thing about bipolar disorder. But and then we forget too that, you know, the hypomania normally, you know, is followed by depression.
Yeah. When you say that you chased those highs, was that one of the reasons that you came off the medication, because you wanted to experience the highs?
Absolutely.
Right.
I mean, you can liken it to a lot of recreational drugs that are out there, but, you know, it just for me, it lasted for 6 weeks at least.
The high?
Yes.
And were those highs worth the depressions? I guess you went into a big black hole.
A big black hole, and, you know, it wasn't until about 5 years ago I decided that I didn't want to be in those black holes anymore, and that I actually could have fun without the mania.
Right. So all of this is detailed in your book, Spiders, Vampires and Jail Keys. That's a question. It is detailed in the book?
Yes, it is.
Right.
You know, the hypomania, the mania, the psychosis, the depressions. Yeah, they're all in there.
So it seems to me, interviewing you today, that you're a very different Brooke to this Brooke that you've described to our listeners.
Sometimes in between episodes I would be okay. I always had anxiety. And of course, you know, if you feel really good, you will stop your medication. But I did learn that it was very short-lived and was disastrous, actually.
My question was that you're a different Brooke today than what you're describing, what you've described, where you come off your medication, you chase the highs, and then you have this drop into the bleak, big black hole. What's keeping you well today?
Well, I haven't had depression for 5 years now, and no episodes of mania. I work as a nurse with other in an acute service, and the fact that I can actually stay well now and talk to other people that are experiencing what I did, and maybe they can also learn from what's happened to me.
Well, let's come back and talk more to Brooke about how she has turned her mental health around. We're playing B.B. King on Mental Health Radio, Take It From Us, and this track is I Want It So Bad. I'm sorry, I Want You So Bad.
Someone like you, babe. Someone like you.
Taken from us, and I'm host Sheldon Brown, and we're talking to author Brooke O'Neill about her book Spiders, Vampires and Jail Keys. You've explained where the jail keys come into the title of your book, Brooke, and you did mention very sort of just casually about the spiders and the vampires, but they were the result of your psychotic episodes?
Yes, that's correct.
So you were visualising spiders and vampires? What, just spiders crawling over you? Or?
At one point they were crawling over me, and if they weren't crawling over me, they were in every corner of the room.
You could see them?
Yeah, I could actually see them. And, you know, even my daughter can testify that I told her to look under the bed and, you know, get the fly spray out and all that sort of stuff.
She didn't see the spiders?
No, she just pretended to spray, I think.
Did she? Keep mum happy?
Yeah. It was quite frightening, actually, because everything's very intense when you're in that sort of state, and I don't like spiders much.
Right.
The vampire was actually... a nurse came to take my blood at home when I was... just after I'd had my daughter, and I was obviously quite psychotic, and I was actually asleep, and she came into the nurse, blood nurse came into my room, and she said, "I've come to take your blood." And of course I didn't see it like that.
Right.
And I woke up and looked at her, and she was actually a vampire.
And what happened then?
Well, I couldn't move because I was just so shocked by it. And she said to me, "There's no blood coming out." And I looked back at her, and she'd gone back to normal. And she went, "Ah, it's coming out now."
Really?
Yeah, and that's how shocked I was, because it was actually so real, and that was my reality at the time.
So you were so terrified that you couldn't give blood?
Yeah, so terrified.
Right.
And, you know, people don't realise how terrifying it actually is.
So you've really sort of, it sounds as though you've turned around your mental health from a very terrifying and, I guess, you know, these moods must be quite frightening, that you go from manic to, and I guess, do you anticipate that you're going to get into a black hole?
I think the mental health team did.
Right.
They, you know, they kept on saying to me, if you keep doing this, then, you know, you're going to experience more depressions. And I was starting to listen to them, but I think it's human nature to want good things.
Right.
My major suicide attempt, I think, was, you know, the turning point for me. Do I want to live or do I want to die?
Right. But those manic episodes, what you say that you weren't sleeping much, you were doing a whole lot. What were there any other symptoms to your manic periods? You spent a lot of money, which seems to be a traditional thing that can happen.
I bought a horse.
You bought a horse? What? You wanted to go horse racing?
Yeah, definitely. It was, you know, a silly thing to do, but it seemed right at the time, and I mean, we were eventually going to get a horse, but I decided that was the one for me, and yes, I'm getting it.
So you went off and bought it?
Yeah, I went off and bought it.
It cost you a lot of money?
Quite a lot of, a few thousand, yes.
Right. Was it a racing horse?
No, it was just for fun.
Just a riding horse?
I mean, it was good at show jumping.
Right.
But, I wasn't show jumping at the time.
No, I don't suppose you were. Were you going to park it in the backyard?
Well, I mean, we had a couple of acres, but I think it was quite a surprise to my family, and I think my husband was like, "Oh no, here we go again."
Right.
I did buy things. I bought things online during the night. I decided that giving things away was the best thing I could do, and people were really happy about that.
Right. Who did you give them away to?
Friends and family mainly.
So did friends and family remain loyal and supportive? Because one of the things, and I've done this in my my own treatment of depression is that when I feel much better, I used to go off my medication, and my wife at the time used to get very, very, very annoyed and angry with me. And then, of course, I was depressed. I had to start the medication again. I had all the side effects of the particular antidepressants, the old tricyclic antidepressants that often took 3 or 4 weeks to start having any positive effect at all. And so the impact on my family and my children and my work was pretty devastating, and I can understand why she got angry and annoyed with me.
For sure.
But it doesn't take into account the side effects from that medication. Did you have serious side effects?
Not as many side effects as some people experience, I don't think. I'm currently taking lithium, and, you know, of course, if you look up all the side effects, you think, well, I'm going to get that, and I'm going to get that, so I don't want to take it. But I think if people try it first without looking it up, it's quite good. I thought I was going to put on a lot of weight. That was the main thing for me, because I'd heard that some people do, and I was, you know, not very happy about that.
Right. Well, I have been on lithium probably 25, 30 years ago, and my wife at the time believed that I was the most well on lithium. I mean, it's a strange situation with lithium, that it's described as a natural salt, and yet it's the only medication that I've taken where I've had to have blood tests for the throat, the thyroid.
Yeah. I truly believe that lithium has been the most amazing thing for me.
Right.
Now that I've given it a go,
yes,
I haven't stopped taking it for 5 years now.
Right.
And my life has turned around.
So you've stopped taking it now?
No, I'm still taking it.
Oh, you're still taking it now. What are some of the other strategies that you've put in place? And these may be outlined in your book. What other strategies have you put in place to maintain your mental wellness?
Time for myself, I think, is really important. I do some meditation. I think that's really been quite helpful, just to give my brain a bit of a rest, because it is probably more hyperactive than some people's. I also go for walks. I do as much exercise as I can. And the other thing is, I think, is spending time with my family. Because my husband does shift work, and so does my daughter, and I do shift work as well. So we're kind
wow.
of we're trying to get time, you know, to spend with each other.
So you've got three people in the family
all doing shift work.
All doing shift work.
Yeah.
When do you ever get to see each other?
Oh, we kind of work it out somehow.
Do you? Must be quite a challenge.
In some ways, it's good for your relationship. In other ways, you know, you do miss out on a few things. But
right. You say that you like to exercise. Does that include more than just walking?
I've got a bike, which I try and use as much as possible. I love swimming in the summer. I think exercise for me is, you know, great for keeping my mood up.
Right. So it gets the endorphins, the correct endorphins,
yes.
Operating?
Yes, I think so.
Right.
It does make me feel great.
And the meditation, how often do you do that?
Obviously, when I'm on holiday, which I was recently, I try and do it every day, at least twice a week.
So what's involved in that meditation?
It's just, you know, listening to what's going on around me, just the nice, you know, the birds, and just clearing my mind, really. And, you know, obviously you can have quite a bit of stress sometimes, and letting that go. And I think people meditate differently to other people.
I mean, when you're a mother and a wife as well, it's sometimes you've got responsibilities, haven't you? And it's not easy to say to the other people in the house, well, I need 30 minutes to meditate and listen to the birds singing and look out the window. It's
often I'll go outside by myself.
Right.
Yep.
So are you still living on this 2 acres?
Oh, we've got 10 acres now.
Oh, 10 acres. Okay. So you went out and bought the 10 acres when you were in a manic state and then came home and told your husband.
I'm not going to talk about that.
Oh, really?
No.
Oh, well, we better take another music break then. We're playing B.B. King today on Mental Health Radio. Take It From Us. It's from a track which is called Live and Well, which I think is significant in terms of what we're talking about today. And this track is called Friends. B.B. King off a CD called Live and Well. The track is called Friends, and I'm host Sheldon Brown of Mental Health Radio. Take It From Us. Today we're talking to Brooke O'Neill about her book called Spiders, Vampires and Jail Keys. Brooke's name is a pseudonym. She actually works in acute care for Ember, and Ember, of course, is the funder of Mental Health Radio. Take It From Us. We've just had a track, Brooke, called Friends. I mean, how long is it that you've had these mental health experiences?
So it's my daughter's nearly 19, so it's been quite some time. But obviously in the last 5 years I've been reasonably stable, so I've been, you know, very thankful for that.
Right. So, I mean, there is, and this was outlined to me because my mother was very unwell and spent a lot of time in Sunnyside Hospital in Christchurch. My father tried to reassure me that, you know, I, just because my mother was unwell, that I wasn't necessarily going to happen to me. But I think there's about a 20% chance of children inheriting whatever it is, a mental health vulnerability. Has your daughter shown any?
Yes, she has, and we have bipolar disorder on both sides of our family. And she wants to get the gene testing done for that to see whether she does have that vulnerability at all. But to me, it's, you know, she may never have that show up.
Right.
So for me, it's, I think she should leave it and see what happens. But for her, that's important, so.
So you mean that you're saying to her that it's probably not a good idea to test for the bipolar gene?
Well, quite often it's, you know, it can be lurking around, but she may have nothing that ever triggers it off. Mm. So, you know, do you say, well, I may get it, or, you know, it's definitely there?
I guess one of the things about our vulnerability and mental health is that when I find anyway that when there's a hint that I might be getting anxious or my mood is going down or I'm feeling that I'm overwhelmed or overpowered, that I get fearful. Does that happen to you, that you may be fearful that you're going to have another episode?
You know, and it could be quite likely that it does happen. I mean, it's never cured.
Right. Do you get fearful, though, that you may be sort of heading for another episode?
I think in the last 2 years, I've actually kind of forgotten about it.
Right.
I'm sleeping well, so that's a, you know, that's a major factor in keeping me well.
Yeah.
And, you know, like you said before about meditation and things, I think sleeping is a huge factor.
Right. So it sounds as though you've got a really nice balance in terms of addressing your mental health vulnerability. You've got some medication, and then you've got these natural strategies like mindfulness or meditation and walking and exercise and that sort of thing.
And I think, you know, you do need a good balance. And it's very easy to feel, you know, when you're really anxious not to do anything, you know, including exercise, but it's always something you have to force yourself to do.
So we played this track by B.B. King called Friends. How have your friends been through this rollercoaster ride?
I've been very, very lucky, actually. Most of my friends are very long-term friends, and they accept me for who I am, which, you know, I've really been blessed by that. There have been people that have, you know, decided that because I've got a mental illness that they don't want to see me anymore. And that's okay. And, you know, initially I was very, very, very sad about that. But I've decided that if they can't accept me for who I am, then I don't want to spend time with them.
Right.
And they're not friends.
So they were a bit discriminatory towards you?
I mean, I guess my behaviour was quite odd sometimes, and instead of them thinking, well, you know, this is going to pass, I think they thought I was going to be like that forever.
Right.
Yeah.
What did they say to you?
They didn't say much, actually. They just stopped.
Right.
Yeah.
You
can only do so much saying, oh, do you want to catch up or, you know.
Right. But you've learned that, if they're not going to be compassionate and understanding, that really you don't want them in your life.
That's correct.
Yeah.
And, you know, I'm very open about my mental health issues. I have, you know, if someone talks about mental health issues, then I'll bring up that I have bipolar disorder.
Right.
I might go to a party and, you know, someone brings up mental health, and so I say, oh, I work, you know, mental health, and they go, oh, my brother's got schizophrenia, or, you know, you can just have this open conversation. And, you know, I say, well, I've got bipolar disorder, and they go, oh, I know someone with bipolar disorder, and it's a conversation starter, really.
You find that most people are accepting of talking about mental health, or do some people shy away from it?
It seems lately, or, you know, in the last few years, that people are more open.
Right.
And I think that's amazing.
Why do you think that is?
I think it's become more acceptable. More people are talking about it.
Well, when we have a suicide rate of 685 a year, it's got to come to the forefront, doesn't it?
It has to.
Not that those with mental health are necessarily the majority of people who commit suicide, but how have employers treated you in terms of your mental health?
Obviously, my recent employers have been amazing. You know, if people are feeling unwell, they're said, go and have some time off. They're told, you know, it's okay. Whereas in, you know, some of my old jobs, my employer did find out that I had bipolar disorder, and she was very discriminatory towards me. She said that I was no longer sustainable to the business. So
was that a commercial organisation?
That was a hospital.
A hospital?
Yeah.
You would hope that that's a caring environment.
It wasn't mental health at all.
No, but it's a hospital.
Yeah, and I mean, these are managers.
Right.
They're not charged nurses or...
So did you lose your job because of your mental health?
Pretty much, I would say. It came to a point where I wasn't invited anymore to the Christmas party because I'd had so much time off with my mental health.
Oh, really?
And that really pushed me into a very, very dark place.
So that was totally responsible for you going into a really dark place?
Definitely.
Were you able to say that to your employer?
No, I just left. And that's exactly what she wanted.
So you were forced out of a job because of your mental health?
Yeah, I mean, you can only take so much of someone saying that to you, and, you know, and you're better off actually working for someone that's going to be a bit more understandable.
But it's very discriminatory and not at all compassionate. Did you take any action against them?
No, I ended up in hospital myself.
Wow.
Yeah. So, I mean, if I had been strong enough to do something, I would have.
Right.
But in the end, it just wasn't worth it for me. And it would have been more stress. So
these things are detailed in your book, Spiders, Vampires and Jail Keys?
They are indeed.
All of them. Right. How big a book is it? How many pages?
It's not a huge book. It's about 200 pages. I guess it's an easy read.
Right. Well, it's very, very well written, I must say. I read the introduction on not Tinder, but Kindle.
Yeah.
So, and I was very, very impressed with the introduction. What other feedback have you had about it?
Quite a few people have said that it's inspired them. One person in particular said that she wants to write her own book. And I think they're, on the whole, very thankful that I've shared my story.
Right. So tell us again how people can access this book, because it's on, well, you tell me that first, because it's very reasonably priced, isn't it?
At the moment it's on Amazon Books, so you just put the title in, Spiders, Vampires and Jail Keys, and it will come up. And you just need to have the Kindle app on either your phone or your tablet, and you'll be able to download it. It's $5.
So it's easy to upload the Kindle app?
Yes, it's very simple.
Right.
If you know what you're doing.
And the book costs?
$5.
$5, right. Have you had any other interest in the book from other publishers? Or anybody saying to you, we want you to write another book? Or?
I have been asked if I'm going to write another book, and I said that's on hold at the moment.
What would you write it about?
I actually don't know. But it could be self-help things, perhaps.
Buying a 10-acre property when you're slightly high.
Could be too.
Yeah, well, congratulations on, achieving this publication. It's called Spiders, Vampires and Jail Keys. It's by Brooke O'Neill. That is her pseudonym, and it's been great talking to you today, Brooke.
Oh, thank you, Sheldon. Yeah. Thank you for having me here.
Every morning.